The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you. So I want to just get a sense of who's in the room by asking, how many people here work in social services of some sort? Okay. How many people here have received social services, have been on the receiving end of welfare benefits? Okay. And how many people have not had either of those direct experiences but are just interested in the topic? Okay, cool. So it looks like it's about an even mix between everyone. So about 20% of the U.S. population receives public assistance, and this includes a wide variety of provisions. Medicare is our federal health insurance program covering people 65 or over and those with a disability regardless of income. It does not cover all medical costs, and long-term care in particular is usually not covered. Medicaid is jointly funded at the federal and state level and supports low-income individuals and families by covering costs associated with both medical and long-term custodial care for those who qualify. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which is also known as food stamps, recipients must meet work requirements unless they are exempt because of age or disability or any other specific reason. And there's a specific category under SNAP called able-bodied adults without dependent children. And they can receive SNAP, but only for 3 months in 3 years if they fail to meet work requirements. And for a household of two, income limit is $1,736 a month. The Supplemental Security Income, or SSI program, provides benefits to adults and children with disability and seniors 65 or older who meet income limits. Most cash benefits come from Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which replaced the aid to families with dependent children. This is a temporary aid and has work requirements as well. For single parents, they must work 30 hours a week, and failure to meet these requirements can often result in loss of benefits. There is no federally supported cash safety net for poor, childless adults who do not qualify for Social Security. And these are a lot of people that you see who are homeless and who are at the very bottom rungs of poverty. General assistance is the state-level cash assistance program of last resort. Since the 1980s, 23 states have eliminated their general assistance program altogether. Of the states that still have these programs, the maximum allowances are capped at half the poverty line, with many states capping it at one quarter of the poverty line. And adding up all these programs, the average monthly benefit is $400. So all of these benefits are means tested, time limited, and contingent upon regular involvement in employment and vocational training. Benefits, even if you are significantly disabled by a health condition, you must prove that you are still disabled over time to continue to receive benefits. And in general, you have to prove that you are either able-bodied and eager to work in order to receive cash benefits, or that you are too disabled to work and thus meet eligibility for Social Security income. So the system is not actually about accommodating people with disability or providing a safety net for poor people, but rather sorting them into a category of non-worker, and the price for qualifying for disability is a life of poverty. The fact is that the majority of people become disabled due to social and environmental causes. Workplace accidents, environmental pollution, inability to access quality health care, exposure to trauma, etc. And it's important to say that disability does not equal impairment. Impairment is something that affects the operation of a limb, an organ, or a body system, and it may change the way one works or functions in daily life, and it may limit someone's daily activities. Disability, however, is how an individual with an impairment is restricted in opportunity, rights, and resources because of the impairment. And the category of disabled person is defined by one's ability to work under capitalist social relations. So many social services, and even more so, are being delivered through a combination of public and private providers. Nonprofits are appealing to local governments who reduce their labor costs and create a buffer layer of management to maintain a low-wage workforce. They are also appealing to community members and people who have been through the system because they often have services that are easier to access, more culturally responsive and more culturally responsive services, and sometimes allow greater freedom to providers to determine their programs. However, all nonprofits are consumed with securing funding. And nonprofits are basically run like corporations with very undemocratic leadership structures. There's usually a very much higher paid management level and a very low wage workforce that does all the frontline work. And nonprofits have to compete for contracts by convincing governments that they can provide more services at a lower cost. And I think we have something we have to talk about because this is becoming an even greater and greater trend. For those of us who work in social services, chances are that we are being paid low wages, experience work conditions that involve violence, trauma, and contact with the police. The bureaucracy of the social welfare system means that we are likely spending most of our time doing data entry and documentation rather than actual face-to-face helping people. And while you may be able to provide a limited amount of resources for clients, those resources that would have the biggest impact on people's lives, like housing and jobs and healthcare, are controlled by a political class who sees our clients as cases to be managed and ideally closed. Our current welfare regime is shaped largely by the neoliberal transformation of the welfare state during the right-wing backlash to the gains of the civil rights era, which explicitly attacked black mothers as welfare queens and unwed mothers who were supposedly destroying the family. Bill Clinton's 1996 Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act and Temporary Assistance for Needy Families placed mandates on states to place 25% of their welfare recipients in jobs or work-related activities by 1997 and 50% by 2002 or risk losing federal welfare funding. Workfare reinforces the reserve army of labor and serves the capitalists by lowering the standard of living for all workers, increasing competition within the labor market, and creating a labor of workers who are forced to endure hyper-exploitation for fear of losing benefits and falling into deeper poverty. Workfare also serves an ideological purpose by reinforcing the capitalist morality of hard work and the condemnation of the so-called lazy poor. Poverty is racialized and criminalized so as to demonize poor people into something that no one wants to be associated with. Because black people are disproportionately represented among welfare recipients, racism is used to justify attacks on welfare programs. The real face of poverty has always reflected broad sections of the working class, whether for periods of crisis or long term. And the majority of people receiving welfare are white and white women and children, yet racism continues to be the primary way that they attack welfare benefits for all. These stark inequalities are obvious to anybody who's looking, and require ideological weapons to convince people that these inequalities are in fact natural. We see this most obviously in the determinist claims about human biology and behavior. Biological determinism suggests that poor people are biologically defective, and that's why their lot in life is so bad. This racist and sexist ideology continues to thrive in fields of sociobiology, medicine, and psychiatry. Its current form is the obsession over the human genome and the potential to explain all human behavior through the identification of genes. Cultural determinism suggests that people are simply mirrors of their environment. An example of this is the culture of poverty argument. Another example is behaviorism, which I think is still prevalent in special education and psychology. Both cultural and biological determinism argues that causes of the events of life of an organism can be partitioned out into biological or nature and cultural or nurture, and the proportion together somehow adds up to 100%. Maintaining a discrete and separable and non-interpenetrating nature of phenomenon. Humans, and all organisms in fact, don't simply adapt to previously existing autonomous environments, however. They create, destroy, modify, and internally transform aspects of the external world by their own activities to make this environment. We are not victims of our biology or our social environment, but agents in transforming both. And the reality is that poverty has real biological consequences for people. It shortens your life, it puts you in danger of violence and abuse, and it isolates you from social life in general. Any attempts at explaining away this inhumane treatment only serves to preserve capitalist social relations of inequality. Attempts to marginalize, criminalize, and punish people who experience poverty and homelessness serve to drive a wedge between wage earners and unemployed workers. It also stigmatizes welfare so that many people who are eligible do not even attempt to apply for benefits. So, not all welfare regimes are as cruel and heartless as the United States. Although the determination of welfare provisions is not a moral question, but a political one. It is not an accident that the happiest countries in the world are the ones that have a strong legacy of social democracy and provide the most generous welfare programs. Many countries that follow the Scandinavian model provide free education and healthcare, extended paternal leave, free childcare, daycare, etc. And it is important for us to consider how winning these rights can have profound effects on the working class. The balance of class power is fundamentally altered when workers enjoy social rights, for the social wage lessens the workers' dependence on the market and employers, and thus turns into a potential power resource for our side. We are used to means-tested welfare provision as it sorts and stratifies layers of people who are deserving of relief and those who are not. This weakens labor solidarity and allows for further social isolation and marginalization. Now, there's a theorist on social welfare that I recommend people check out named Gösta Esping Andersson. And he provides a helpful way to think about the differences in welfare provisions across various regimes. And he talks about whether or not welfare is commodified or decommodified. And so if social rights like healthcare, housing, education, if these are granted on the basis of citizenship or on a universal level rather than on performance or means tested, they will entail a decommodification of individuals vis-a-vis the market. Decommodification occurs when a service is rendered as a matter of right and when a person can maintain a livelihood without reliance on the market. Even countries which have universal decommodified welfare, though, health disparities still persist. In Sweden, for instance, mental health conditions are the most common work-related health problem in Sweden, accounting for the most number of sick days and people missing work. This suggests that even when benefits are relatively universal and decommodified, there is something about working under capitalism that is deeply alienating and unsatisfying. And social democracy can only go so far in relieving the worst aspects of oppression and inequality. Ultimately, the very fact of racism, class inequality, sexism, etc., means that people have drastically different life experiences that produce major impacts on their health and wellness. And just an example of this is there's a famous Whitehall study of public sector workers in England that basically documented people on a whole scale of pay grade and management level and saw that there was a gradient in health according to all of those things. So people had greater control over their job, that got paid better, had more respect, actually had better health consequences coming out. So even amongst a relatively homogenous group, these gradients will manifest. If capitalism requires inequality to maintain social relations, then we have to ultimately get rid of the capitalist system as a whole. And a revolutionary perspective is still necessary if you want to have a world where people are taken care of, not just in order to grind themselves away at low wage and dangerous jobs. Ultimately, social democracy is about mitigating the inequality inherent in capitalism by eliminating its most extreme elements. But as long as capitalist social relations remain intact, people will continue to experience unequal lives. So these social inequalities manifest in health disparities because we have a metabolic relationship with our environment. This creates significant differences in mortality dependent on race, gender, and class. So living in poor neighborhoods means more violence, more police, more environmental pollution, smaller living quarters, underfunded schools, etc., etc. For black people, it means the constant fear of police brutality. For women, it is the constant stress of street harassment, job harassment, daily misogyny, increased victimization of violence and assault, and diminished control over our bodies. And this causes increased rates in anxiety, PTSD, and low self-esteem. For black trans women, it means their lives are under constant threat of violence, poverty, and involvement with the criminal justice system. For people who get caught up in the carceral state, trauma is meted out casually and lethally. Unfortunately, the attack on social services are at an all-time high, providing us with the task of defending what we have, extending these benefits to greater numbers of people, and transforming them to actually meet the needs of people. Our approach should prioritize an increase in social rights, decrease in commodification, put forward a revolutionary perspective about the necessity of getting rid of capitalist social relations. Because welfare is primarily about addressing poverty, we have to link the various struggles that address this question: housing, healthcare, education, feminism, and racism. We have to demand that healthcare is a human right, which means liberating care from the insurance companies. Doctors know this, nurses know this, and patients clearly know this. Big pharma and insurance companies are among the most profitable forces in the healthcare industry. And this is why Democrats and Republicans are not willing to fight for universal health care. And in fact, I just read an article that showed that Republican lawmakers are buying up health insurance stock as they try to destroy the Affordable Care Act. And I'm sure Democrats are doing the same thing. So gentrification has become one of the biggest public health crises that we face right now. And one of the consequences is that poverty is actually growing faster in suburbs than it is in cities right now. So you can see that what was once thought of something that's concentrated in inner cities has actually expanded much more broadly because of gentrification. One of the consequences is rising homelessness and more visible homelessness as tent cities are popping up all across the country. Unfortunately, the trend for most city governments is to expand shelters rather than increase public housing and attack tent communities rather than allowing people places to live. This is because land values have become so high that any housing taken off the housing stock means millions of dollars that could be going to developers. Our interests are directly opposed, and they definitely know it. Affordable housing has become the term du jour for housing activists and politicians alike, as no one can deny that the rent is too damn high. But the demand for so-called affordable housing in some ways concedes to the logic of the market, often demanding that a very small percentage of market rate development is allotted as affordable. Instead, we need to halt market rate and luxury development, as this is the driving force of gentrification and homelessness. Additionally, affordability is measured by area median income, leaving out the growing population of chronically homeless and those living in deep poverty. It also leaves out sections of workers who don't qualify, but who also don't make enough money to afford market rate rent. And this is a very large group of people who are increasingly spending nearly half their income on rent. Real public housing would be land that is removed from the market, owned by the government, and funded by rich taxpayers. Student loan debt is crippling an entire generation of young workers who will be paying the price of their education for decades. That means just barely getting by for many people who work in social services and who have tens of thousands of dollars in student loan debts. Public education is becoming more segregated and more violent as schools are expected to address not only the educational goals of students, but provide the only reliable meal some kids will eat in a day, provide mental health services for students who have been traumatized by violence, poverty, and racism. Feminism is highly implicated in the field of social welfare as well. Women are disproportionately the recipients and bear the burden of heading the majority of households that live in poverty. Mirroring women's disproportionate role in caring for people within the private family is the disproportionate number of women caring for people outside the home, in hospitals, shelters, nursing facilities, schools, daycare, etc. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in the nursing field, 91% are women. Elementary, middle school, 81% are women. And in social work, among social workers, 80%. These workplace struggles should be and must be considered feminist struggles as well. So those of us who work in the realm of social reproduction and social services should look to the experience of the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, as a guide for how you build solidarity between those who work in social services and those who receive these services by putting issues of race and class at the forefront. Our work conditions affect our clients and patients. When we're asked to work longer hours, it means we're not able to be effective at our jobs. When we are stressed out about how we will pay off our student loans, rent, therapy, we are not able to provide services effectively. We are often mandated to call the police in instances of child abuse, elder abuse, danger to oneself and others, and can lose our jobs if we don't comply. But we know that getting the police involved necessarily means depriving people of their self-determination, and thus we are in a bind between what we are supposed to do and what is best for the people who are receiving services. One of the major causes of poverty and human misery in our country is the carceral state. People who are homeless and poor experience daily police harassment and brutality. The most vulnerable populations are at greatest risk for police abuse. So along with these sort of concrete reforms that we can fight for, there are many, I think, dominant paradigms around poverty and welfare that we also need to challenge. One is the idea that being a productive worker should be valorized. It's understandable why capitalists and politicians who represent their interests would want to valorize workers' productivity. But under capitalism, greater productivity means greater exploitation and greater profits for the bosses. Instead, we should demand that workers get more leisure time and work less so they can pursue life activities outside of what is obligatory to barely survive. We should also reject the idea that people with disabilities cannot contribute meaningfully to society. People who are categorized as disabled can work, but chances are workplaces cannot make accommodations necessary to allow that person to work without pain, distress, injury, etc. Additionally, if we had a society based on human need, we could focus on people's abilities to do lots of wonderful things and not their inability to conform to capitalist social relations. We need to reject the idea that mental illness is some kind of abnormal psychology that makes people a danger to others. The fact is that depression, anxiety, even psychosis are all a part of the human experience. They can become debilitating when adequate supports are not available and when poverty defines every aspect of your life. We have to end the stigma attached with poverty and mental illness, not only if we wish to keep our humanity, but if any of us can find ourselves homeless, without health care, in poverty, in a health crisis. Criminalization and marginalization of those who receive welfare actually dilutes working class solidarity and perpetuates capitalist ideology. People who go into social service field do so because they are compassionate helpers who want to make the world a better place. But the system that we work in grinds us down, pays us less than we deserve, and forces us to participate in coercive aspects of the integral state. We have an interest in challenging the dominant ideology and providing an alternative vision of the kind of society that we want to live in. Thank you.
And now we'll have Don Lash.
Thank you, and good morning. That was excellent. My focus will probably be a little narrower on the child welfare system. I think there are some insights about the relationship of the institutions of the coercive state and the ideological functions that through civil society that have a broader application, and certainly the discussion of social reproduction, I think, has a much broader application than just to the child welfare system. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm kind of going to stay in my lane. The analysis of the child welfare system that ended up in When the Welfare People Come really took some time for me to develop. I didn't grow up in a family that ever had any reason to worry about state intervention, or in a neighborhood where that was even something people thought very much about. When I started working within the system about 12 years ago, I took it as a given that the primary purpose of the system serves is the protection of children from abuse and neglect. And I think the vast majority of people who work within the system do the very best they can to maintain the subjective belief that that's what they're doing, even though most come to realize that the system isn't really effective at protecting children. So the system can't really be judged successful by its stated purpose, because there isn't data demonstrating a correlation between the aggressiveness of the system in different jurisdictions and child safety. Philadelphia and Los Angeles maintain rates of removal, of taking children from their homes, several times higher than do Chicago and New York, but there's no demonstration that children are safer in those cities, or that any individual child is going to be safer in foster care than in his or her home. Sometimes there's data to the contrary. What the data does show is that the two factors most relevant to child welfare intervention are poverty and race. Black children and Native American children are represented in foster care at about double their percentage of the general childhood population, while white and Asian children are significantly underrepresented. The removal rates are calculated, they generally calculate them two ways. One is removals per 1,000 children, and the other is by removals per 1,000 impoverished children. So you're not comparing the rate of removal of poor children as opposed to non-impoverished children. You're comparing the rate of removal of children by two pools of comparison. The latter, removal by measured by impoverished children, is about four times higher than if you measure the general population. So the system isn't making children demonstrably safer. So what purpose does it really serve? I maintain that looking at the history of the system since it emerged in the late 19th century until the present day, and at how it operates in practice, it's clear that the child welfare system exists in its present form in order to regulate and police poor and working class families of color. Dorothy Roberts once said that if you went into a family court or a dependency court in some big city and didn't know anything about it before you got there, you would think it was a special court specifically designed to punish black mothers. Now that wasn't always the case. 100 years ago, the system largely ignored black families and concentrated on immigrants, mostly Catholic immigrants. Black families were concentrated in the rural South, and they were regulated first by slavery, where the slave master's authority was legally substituted for the enslaved parent, and later sharecropping and Jim Crow, which were used to control and exploit entire families. As the black population became increasingly concentrated in deindustrializing urban centers, the child welfare system began to focus on black mothers and children at the same time the prison industrial complex was becoming more and more heavily populated by black men. And frequently the same neighborhoods and the same families were and are heavily interacting with both systems. The truth is that if you're going to maintain an economic order that of necessity consigns 40% of children of color to poverty, you're going to need a system that looks the way the child welfare system looks. Children will lack secure, adequate housing and the basic necessities of life, and parents will face extraordinary pressures and won't have access to childcare, mental health services, and other supports that middle class and affluent families take for granted. Intervention will be seen to be necessary, but it won't be intervention designed primarily to solve the problems of children and families, despite, again, the subjective intention of the people who work within the system. The primary purpose of the institutions is to prevent the disruption of capital. In the 19th century, that was fairly explicit. Charles Loring Brace, who was a sort of patrician reformer and the architect of what became the American foster boarding home model, talked about, quote, dangerous classes, unquote, of children who would grow up to undermine the social order if they weren't provided for. And that was his fundraising strategy. It was all about fear-mongering. The raising money from the upper class by saying, we're going to have an army of uncontrollable kids when they grow up. Nowadays, it's more fashionable to talk about, quote, breaking the cycle of poverty and dependency, but I would argue the impulse is similar. The Marxist concept of social reproduction, I think, is incredibly useful in explaining the differentiated expectations and regulation relative to poor and working class families and middle class and affluent families. That goes well beyond the child welfare system and includes vastly different educational experiences and different approaches to healthcare. Capital has different requirements for those who are expected to enter the most exploited segments of the workforce or those likely to have a tenuous connection at best to gainful employment than it does for those who will own and manage the economy. In the Adoption and Safe Families Act, ASFA, which is the Clinton-era legislation that largely governs the system, there's a rule, and I'm simplifying it, stating that if a child has been in foster care for 15 months out of a 22-month period, the system is supposed to move to terminate the parent's rights on the grounds that children require, quote, permanency, unquote, and that a parent who has not lived with her child for 15 months is not providing permanency. Imagine if we applied that rationale to a non-custodial parent in a divorce. We wouldn't do that because that would cut across class lines, and we are far more deferential to middle class and affluent parents. There's a history of interference with the right to be a parent that unifies racial, gender, and disability oppression and the many intersections between those forms of oppression. Whether it includes welfare recipients or defendants in drug prosecutions coerced into sterilization or long-term contraceptives, or women with mental and developmental disabilities who've had their children taken at birth based solely on a diagnosis, the factors of race, disability, and poverty are generally tangled in these cases. And it's, the fact that disabled people as a class are generally impoverished also helps to explain why parents with disabilities are overrepresented in the system, in addition to the bias. And the constant is the sense of the ruling class that it has the right and the need to control and regulate poor and working class reproduction and child rearing. This was most explicit during the height of eugenic sterilization of mostly women with developmental disabilities, but continued more discreetly with campaigns to sterilize Black, Indigenous, and Puerto Rican women long after eugenic pseudoscience had been discredited. The child welfare system combines aspects of the coercive state with the ideological functions of civil society, to use Gramsci's terms. If you don't open your door to child protective workers, they may be able to get a court order allowing them to come back with the police. They may also be able to go to your child's school and take the child into custody and then seek an order to remand the child into care. So the institutions have the characteristics of the coercive state. But the system also has important ideological functions. They are carried out through training of, quote, mandated reporters, unquote, the so-called sentinels, that monitor children for abuse and neglect in schools, daycare centers, hospitals, and other healthcare facilities and elsewhere. And they're most vigilant in public hospitals, in poor neighborhoods, in schools, in poor neighborhoods. The calls coming from those areas are much higher than, you know, from middle class schools and hospitals. They're also carried out through public information campaigns. And the ideological narrative seems to design to convince people that the biggest threat to poor children is their parents and not racialized poverty under capitalism. And there's a subtle difference between the sort of moralistic poverty is a choice, personal responsibility arguments made by conservatives, and the arguments that poverty breeds pathology and generates the need for treatment advanced by liberals. But the underlying narratives are that poor people are suspect when it comes to parenting and need to be watched. I mentioned that developing the analysis in my book took me some time. What I discovered when I started talking to parent advocates, mostly those in and around the Child Welfare Organizing Project in New York City, was that the women who found their way to that organization had a far better grasp of the relationship between the child welfare system and the families it monitors and sometimes disrupts than I did. They were quicker studies than I was. People living in neighborhoods where child welfare agencies are active tend to have a clearer perception of its biases, even when they lack information about the law or how the system is financed. Sometimes you see these sort of urban legends about how child welfare workers get paid by the number of children they remove, or that cities have a financial incentive to grow and expand their foster care population. there's a grain of truth in that there are financial incentives for promoting adoption to achieve permanency, but these are kind of gross oversimplifications. And yet, they often go along with a keen political understanding of the underlying dynamics between the families and the system. And that brings me to the next point, which is that the struggles for reform in child welfare need to be led by parent activists, supported by people who work within the system, along with their unions and professional associations, hopefully bolstered by a renewed and revitalized tradition of professional radicalism and social justice unionism. The Scandinavian model was mentioned, and I agree entirely that the kind of material supports that are available under that model are essential, but there's also an elitism in Scandinavian child welfare, and some increasingly racial disparity. So, you know, a top-down model isn't necessarily what we're looking for, even though we want those material supports. So I think parent activism is essential in that. The emphasis has to be both on changing the institutions of the coercive state to turn punitive intervention into problem solving, and also on constructing a counter narrative to stop the scapegoating of poor parents, almost invariably mothers. Only parent leaders can do that, because the current system invests tremendous resources in breaking down parents' will to assert themselves and forcing them to internalize blame and act out rituals that the writer Tina Lee describes as, quote, doing compliance, unquote, which means towing the line and adhering to the requirements of service plans, such as anger management and parenting classes, that may do little to address the stressors and crises that brought the family into contact with the system in the first place. But people will do what they have to do to get their kids back. That has an impact, and to build a larger movement drawing in large numbers of parents affected by the system, you need leaders who have been affected by the system and have developed their politics. Moreover, parent advocates, in my experience, don't need to be convinced that their struggles are connected to other anti-racist struggles and struggles for economic justice. The parent leaders I know in New York are connected to Black Lives Matter, to the fights against mass incarceration and stop and frisk. And the Child Welfare Organizing Project began making trips to the Occupy Wall Street encampment at Zuccotti Park at about the same time we in the ISO did. I mean, they were there at the beginning, in solidarity. In my experience, parent leaders are very receptive to insights from the Marxist tradition. I've done panels and talks to audiences of parents, some of whom have come up afterwards to ask me, how do you spell Gramsci or Lise Vogel? These are parents who are fighting to get their kids back and who could be forgiven for believing they have no time for abstract political discussion, but they recognize that sharpening their analysis of their own oppression is not abstraction, but is very important to the development of effective politics to make their activism more effective. To families assaulted by racism and neoliberalism, that presents a challenge to us as Marxists, because I think we need to get better at how we talk about nuclear families. To families assaulted by racism and neoliberalism, Marxist rhetoric about replacing or abolishing the nuclear family can sound very threatening, especially if it comes from Engels. And we need to clarify that we aim to liberate people from the restraints of family life imposed by capitalism and enable people to build the lives for themselves and their children that they want. Because the nuclear family shouldn't be about imposing the burden of raising the next generation of workers on parents to serve the interest of capital, but about making those relationships more about nurturing and educating and less about meeting material needs. The last chapter of my book deals with that challenge, and I hope there'll be more discussion about it. There's an interesting story in there about Alexandra Kollontai in 1918, talking to a group of peasant women and about liberating them. And, you know, peasant women in Tsarist Russia were desperately in need of liberation, and yet she was being heckled. And the women were yelling, "We're not giving up our children, we're not giving up our children." And she responded powerfully in what became Communism and the Family. She kind of polished it up, and it was published as an essay, which you can get on Marxist.org, which I recommend. And she was basically making that point. No one's trying to break up your family. We're trying to change the role within the family and allow you to do with your family what you wish, to construct it how you want, to construct gender roles the way you want, to have involvement with other people's kids if that's a natural fit, whatever it is, but to stop the rigid limitation of family life under capitalism. I want to briefly talk about some of the trends that I think we need to watch out for, some of which predate Trump, but can be expected to accelerate in the current climate. One is privatization. There have been experiments in expanding the privatization of child welfare services, which were often semi-privatized with traditional NGOs, but these experiments have been aimed at wholly privatizing and even introducing for-profit business into child welfare services. Under Obama, the Department of Health and Human Services was largely agnostic on the question. But under Trump, I would imagine that once he gets around to staffing up those parts of HHS, which fortunately he hasn't yet, the political appointees in the federal government will be true believers. The fact that privatization experiments in states have either failed miserably and needed to be bailed out, or have simply siphoned off resources to highly paid managers and NGOs and for-profit companies hasn't generally made much of an impression on the true believers, and there's no reason to expect that to change. Another trend is the ramping up of the use of adoption subsidies and fast-track procedures to enhance privatization. There are already subsidies built into the system, but there are proposals to go much further and create a national adoption market. Right-wing economists have suggested an auction model because, quote, "The shortage of white infants and the simultaneous surplus of older minority or disabled children is an indication that the adoption system needs reform. Because the goal is to maximize the quality of placement for all children and not to use adoption as a vehicle to improve family equity, adoption is a situation where markets can help. Auctions will raise revenues for endowing children that are otherwise difficult to place, giving greater numbers of children access to permanent family environments," unquote. So in other words, you sell the commercially desirable babies at a higher price, and you use that revenue to subsidize the sale of the less commercially desirable babies. But not to worry, the market won't be completely unregulated. The Economist proposed a lemon law. A lemon law requiring medical testing and disclosure to buyers, saying, quote, "The high proportion of unhealthy babies drives the healthy babies from the agency in that no prospective parent is willing to incur the risk of getting an unhealthy baby. This phenomenon is known as the market for lemons and was first used by economists to model the market for used cars," unquote. And of course, there are broader threats that are likely to devastate the families most at risk of involvement with the child welfare and juvenile justice system. Draconian cuts to Medicaid and public housing, child care and food stamps, mental health services, and reproductive health. We need to recognize how much pressure further cuts to the already inadequate social supports in the U.S. would put on child protection resources and how fragile that system actually is. Child welfare can't remain aloof from the broader fights. I want to close by talking about what child welfare policy and practice might look like under socialism. A transition to socialism would entail an acceptance of responsibility by society for the material needs of children and a redefinition of the role of the nuclear family from an economic one to one based on freedom to build the family life one chooses. That doesn't mean shipping the kids off to a communal childcare farm, although as a parent I must admit the idea occasionally has a passing attraction. I wrote that joke before I realized my kids were going to be in the room. So, I'm just kidding. But I can't talk for mommy. It means ending capitalism's rigid gender restrictions, and it means communal sharing of material supports while preserving desired realms of family privacy. It would mean communities coming together to solve problems without blaming or stigmatizing parents. And I hope we'll always aspire to a society that intervenes to help families in crisis, but the reordering of social relationships following the demise of capitalism should sharply reduce the incidence of the type of crises the child welfare system currently responds to. Without the immiseration that comes with capitalism, frustrations that break down parents' abilities to care for their children will be reduced, and with greater social responsibility for the material needs of children, lack of housing, food, and childcare should no longer result in coercive intervention. Non-punitive, community-based responses to the dwindling numbers of children of care at risk should be more effective and less traumatic to children and family life. So to me, that's the long-term goal, and we're recognizably a long way from that. So we need to talk about reforms, and the reforms we work toward while we fight the larger fight against capitalism should all be consistent with incrementally moving the relationship between poor and working class families and child welfare supports and mechanisms toward that which would exist in the world we hope to build. And approaching it with that reform from below perspective, while prioritizing the leadership of families affected by the system, will give us common ground with parent leaders and true proponents of meaningful reform within the system, regardless of whether they now see themselves as socialists or Marxists. So having said that, I look forward to the discussion.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.